Good afternoon and welcome to the Lunchroom on Radio Caribbean International. It is Tuesday, April the 1st, 2025, and this is program number 1347. I'm your host, Calix George Jr. Now, of course, in addition to radio 101.1 FM, you can also get us at our website, rcistlucia.com, and you can download our previous shows on that platform as well. We are also streaming live on Facebook. You just have to search for the official page of Radio Caribbean International. And please be sure to like and share that as well with your friends and family. And if you want to call in to tell us what's on your plate today, you can do so by calling in to 452-3046, 452-3046. We also have a number on WhatsApp, which you can reach us on, and that is as well 724-0008. Again, 724-0008. Now, some birthday greetings for today. We want to send out some best wishes to Mr. Khalid Vidal, of course, who you would have known him as one of our former presenters, the host of Youth Unplugged. So we want to send him best birthday wishes on his very, very special day. And it's also his twin brother's birthday, Khalifa. So we want to send both of them happiest of birthdays. Hope you guys are having a wonderful, wonderful time. Now, a bit of history for today on this day. Back in the year 1748... the ruins of Pompeii were discovered by a Spanish gentleman by the name of Roque Joaquin de Alcubierre. And, of course, that is the famous city destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in Italy. 1948, on this day, the Big Bang Theory was proposed in Scientific Journal. That was the Physical Review, and that was by an American cosmologist by the name of Ralph Alpha. Sorry, in fact, it was a group of them, Ralph Alpha, Hans Bethe, as well as George Gamow. I think on this day back in the year 1964, April the 1st, the United Workers' Party was formed in Vieux-Fort. I think it was a Easter weekend or around that time. And that happened down, of course, the amalgamation of the NLM, National Labor Movement, as well as the People's Progressive Party. 1974, Ayatollah Khomeini called for an Islamic Republic in Iran. 1976, on this day, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs founded Apple Computer in the garage of Jobs' parents' house in Cupertino, California. And on this day in 2001, the Netherlands became the first country in the world to make same-sex marriage legal. We now move on to our dish of the day. The daily dish is brought to you the kind compliments of our good friends at Tiles Plus.
One test for your home, I see. Bathroom, kitchen, pantry. Need test for your balcony. Come down to Tiles Plus, satisfaction guarantee. Tiles Plus, Tiles Plus, Tiles Plus. Big test with unbeatable cost. Customer service, A plus. Need all kind of tests. Come down to Tiles Plus. We also got glassware and vanity. Box, doors, you'll see. Come down, don't mind nobody. We got the best tiles on island. Trust me. We are located Land Street in Castries, Bosses, you Grozy Lanes, and Slack Street in Dufort. Telephone number 453-7939. Tiles Plus.
Serving now, the Daily Dish.
And welcome back to our lunchroom program for today. And, of course, as we mentioned in the news, well, in our intro, when we were looking back in time, I believe today is, in fact, the anniversary of the founding of the United Workers' Party. And that happened about 61 years ago today, back in 1964. And, of course, prior to that, the parties of the time were the St. Lucia Labour Party, which was formed back in October, I believe, of 1950 or 51, and then as well the People's Progressive Party, which was seen to be more of a centre-right party compared to the Labour Party, which was a left-leaning party. And the PPP also seemed to have been a party more towards the likings of the middle class, and was not able to create a base of resonance amongst the masses of the population at that time. Of course, in the periods of the 1950s, this was in the post-World War II era, and the country was still under the throes of colonialism. It was still largely dependent on agriculture. The structure of wealth in the economy was certainly still very much skewed, with a very, very wide base of those who were landless, who were still effectively workers within an agrarian society driven by the production of sugarcane, which had been the principal crop of the island at that point, easily for perhaps the better part of nearly 200 years. And so it was within that setting, of course, of the desire for greater workers' rights, the protest actions which came out from the middle of the 1930s and the Great Depression that was on in that time, a significant surplus of labor, if you like, of course, which certainly influenced the rise of the labor movement in the Caribbean, sort of first kicking off, in fact, in St. Kitts and Nevis, I think, in with the formation of the St. Kitts and Nevis Labor Party back in 1937. And that movement led to the formation of trade unions and as well the desire for better working conditions for really the lot of the population. And by the 1950s, things had shifted somewhat in that post-war era, where you saw the introduction of adult suffrage by 1951, and the election being held there for the first time, actually allowing everybody to be able to have a right to vote. Prior to that, you had to, in fact, there were certain qualifications for you to be able to vote, one of which was you had to have a certain amount of money, or you had to have a certain amount of land, and you also had to be literate. You had to be able to read and write English, that is. And of course, given the nature of the population at that time, it really barred a lot of people from, in fact, being part of that franchise of having the right to vote. And of course, out of that came the rise of the St. Lucia Labour Party, and under that time, under George F.L. Charles, who then engaged in a number of reforms, particularly in the case of social affairs and in labor rights, and implementing expansion of things like healthcare, as well as the community centers and schools, and of course also trying to shift the economy away from what at that time was principally driven by agriculture. In those, and not just agriculture, but an agricultural system that was very much centralized. In those days, of course, we saw the rise of, even before that, the rise of these central factories in the valleys of Roseau, Cul-de-sac, and Mabuya, and as well the in the Vieux-Fort area as well, a central factory located there. And it really meant that the systems of production were being more driven by a very small group of individuals. The economy did have some level of of base in trade, and that was primarily because of the port of Castries and what had been coaling, the dependence on the port of Castries as a point for refueling of for ships. But of course, even at that time, things were changing. The ships would be were changing as well. The fuel sources were changing. They weren't using coal as much. There was a shift more towards oil. And you also saw as well a shift towards how goods were actually shipped. And so you saw the rise later on of container cargo. And that certainly changed the situation in terms of logistics and how much the country could in fact depend on individuals getting a coin or getting a token to bring coal on board a ship or other materials. So that certainly changed tremendously what was existing at that time. And the issues of unemployment were quite real in those days. Right now, the country can talk about and boasting about what less than 10 digits of unemployment for the first time ever. 8.8% I think was recorded in the last in quarter four of 2024, and so of course you're seeing some stuff to boast about. But back in those areas, we didn't even really have very good employment data. And certainly a lot of the people who were coming out of that agrarian sector simply were not finding meaningful employment. So maybe they may have had a job, a seasonal job, maybe in the cane cutting season or in particular times, and they would have to fend through subsistence living, eking out a living in that way. And so, of course, we saw that coming up as being a major issue identified by the leading development economist of his time, of course, Sir William Arthur Lewis, who wrote about that and the need for industrialization of the British West Indies and a shift away from the agrarian sector more into an industrialized sector. And so many of these moves were certainly afoot by the 1950s and 1960s. And then, of course, at that time, in came Mr. John Compton, who had returned from the United Kingdom as a barrister, and joined the St. Lucia Labour Party and wanted to carve his own way into it. Now, at that time as well, we should also mention the rise of the banana industry. There were some early attempts at establishing trade of bananas originally back in the 1930s by the Canadian interests. But then later on in the post-war era, the desire to improve their balance of trade caused for the United Kingdom to, in fact, encourage the production of bananas in their own colonies. And so, starting off with Jamaica, and which already had a pretty active banana industry as a result of this trade with the U.S. and as well Canada. And then they decided to push for the introduction of banana production in the Windward Islands. And so in came Messrs. Van Geest, and the shifting of the economy during the 1950s and into the 1960s away from sugarcane and towards what you might want to call a more equitably divided agricultural sector. And that was because bananas, in fact, could theoretically be grown on smaller farm holdings. And so the shift away from the large estates began to occur during this period. Not to say, of course, that they weren't large estates producing bananas, but there were also a number of other areas engaged in that. Now, of course, the birth of bananas started off in the eastern part of the island, in the Maho and Quiles regions, which in fact is also tied in some respects to Mr. John Compton, because in fact he then went on to represent the interest of that area at the time, which was known as the Eastern District, eventually becoming Denri-Miku, and then being split again in 1974 into four distinct constituencies. And so, of course, since between 1964 right up until 1996, you could effectively say that the story of the United Workers Party was the story of John Compton, John George Melvin Compton, and certainly it almost to some degree sort of marries the ascendancy of the banana industry in St. Lucia, as well as the beginnings of the end of the banana industry in St. Lucia as well. And so that era of green gold, and of course, one of the things that Mr. Compton was in fact pushing back in the 1960s was for a shift in the structure of the ownership of the Banana Association and the role of government involvement. And he took a very populist side in pushing for less government involvement, whereas on the George Charles side, they were pushing for governmental involvement. And invariably, even though he actually ended up winning the 1964 election, he actually chose the path, a path different to what, in fact, he had campaigned on originally back in the 1960s. Perhaps reading the tea leaves and seeing the wisdom in such. We've seen this in the past. We've seen governments do complete about turns in terms of policy. I mean, just quite recently, we've seen that in the case of Germany, where the party that was pushing for maintaining tight guides and controls on debt management, the conservatives, they campaigned on that, and they won and went completely opposite, in fact, and changed the constitution as part of a grand alliance with the outgoing government, the SPD, the Socialist Party, to in fact agree that, look, there's a need for allowing the German state to be able to spend more, given the realities of the time and the need for spending on lots of other things, including defense. And of course, right here in St. Lucia, we've seen sometimes as well where governments will campaign on an issue, like water, for example. We saw that being one of the campaign points of a 2006 resurgence of Mr. John Compton, Sir John Compton at that point, coming back to and in fact saying that, hey, we don't want to touch water and the water should remain completely owned by the government. And of course, subsequent to that, his government, through the minister of the time, Mr. Guy Joseph, in fact continued to pursue an effort towards the more private sector involvement in the water sector. That didn't happen for a lot of other reasons, including accusations of corruption and within the bidding process, which sort of culled that entire process. But we do see sometimes parties taking a particular stance, heading into a campaign, but completely changing gears heading out. Be that as it may, very successful run of support, certainly from 1964 Mr. Compton went on to lead another majority government in 1969. Back then, there were only 10 seats in the House of Assembly. And by 1974, an increase in the number of seats, shifting it to 17, to what we've had since then. And he was then also able to win that 1974 election with a 10-17 majority, adding another 10 seats to the hold. And it, by 1979, however, and of course the 1974 election was a very tumultuous one as well. There was the rise of the Black Power movement. The forces of the time were certainly more influenced by the divisions of the era, the Cold War. Lots of interest being played by the United States of America in the politics of the region in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the shifting of Cuba towards communism, largely being influenced by Russia in particular, or the Soviet Union, USSR. And so, of course, very, very active political climate in the 1974 elections. Of course, accusations of different things and people say it'll be all right in the morning and all of that. But by 1979, with a new leader, in the person of Alan Luisi, the St. Lucia Labour Party was in fact able to regain the seat of government, winning 12 of the 17 seats. That, of course, was short-lived due to infighting, most notably factions of Alan Luisi, as well as George Odlum, the deputy prime minister of the time, leading to a loss of Luisi budget. And by 1982, the return of a John Compton 3 years later to hold power, certainly for almost consistently for up until 1996. He went on to win the 1987 general elections. Of course, in that year, you'd recall that there were two elections in that 1 year. Very close majority there, 9-8 in both those general elections. And of course, very famously, a switch in allegiance in the Labrie seat by then Labour Party candidate Sir Neville Snack. In 1992, of course, another United Workers' Party victory. And beyond then, one began seeing the impacts of global trade and entities such as the WTO and the influence of American banana producers, the Chiquitas and Doles, wanting to really take it all, so to speak, in terms of banana production, and very difficult times indeed by that point. And of course, by 1996, Mr. Compton deciding to, in fact, bow out of politics, and in came Dr. Vaughan Lewis, now Sir Vaughan Lewis, to contest that May 23rd, 1997 general election. They were, of course, defeated, and the worst defeat ever for the United Workers Party, only getting about 37% of the popular vote in that 1997 election, and just one seat, that of Miku North, being held by then Deputy Prime Minister in the time, Louis George. And so, of course, again, attempts of trying to revive the efforts of the United Workers' Party saw Morella Joseph contesting the 2001 general election, not faring very much better. in terms of the popular vote, just going up to about a little under 38% of the popular vote and holding two more seats to bring their total up to three. And it really then took a return of Sir John Compton in 2006 to the, at that point, an octogenarian, Sir John, to regain the hold of the United Workers Party in government. And they were able to gain at that point 11-6 majority against the St. Lucia Labour Party. Of course, there was another switch, and since then we've been dealing with switches, right? And so Stevenson King heading in to 2011, and although they were able to get more votes in that 2011 general election, they still were not able to hold. Lost the popular vote with about 47% of the votes cast in that general election. And since then, we of course have been with Alan Chastney, who has led the United Workers Party into two contests thus far. In 2016, one in which he was successful in being able to pull nearly 55% of the popular vote, and certainly at that point was thus far has been the largest total that the United Workers Party has ever been able to achieve in terms of numbers, about 46,000 votes. That, of course, changed on July 26th of 2021. And therein, Mr. Chastney effectively led the United Workers Party to what could be characterized as its second worst defeat of all time, and only holding on to two seats of the 17. And certainly a significant slide in the share of votes that they were able to hold. In fact, 37,481 votes, which is in fact even lower than the number of votes the United Workers Party got back in 2006, even though the population certainly has grown since then, getting about 43% of the popular vote. So, of course, it's a very interesting time because Mr. Chastney has led the United Workers Party into one electoral defeat thus far. And the big question is, what will happen in the upcoming general election, 2025 or 2026, whatever it may be, and whether, in fact, he will be able to improve on the state of the United Workers Party, even with certainly some of the same figures being very prominent and within the lot, including, of course, the current deputy political leader, Mr. Guy Joseph. So, interesting times ahead, no doubt, for the United Workers Party. That's our dish of the day. And when we come back, we'll take in our weather report.
This has been The Daily Dish.
One test for your home, I see. Bathroom, kitchen, pantry. Need test for your balcony. Come down to Test Plus, satisfaction guarantee. Test Plus, Test Plus, Test Plus. Big test with unbeatable cost. Customer service, A+. Need all kind of tests. Come down to Test Plus. We also got gasway and vanity. Boss, boss, you'll see. Come down, don't mind nobody. We got the best test on island. Trust me. We are located Lance Road in Castries, Bosses, Jules Grozy Lakes, and Slack Street in Dufort. Telephone number 453-7939.
Island style, yeah. We got the time to make you go. Oh. We got the time to make you say, yeah. We'll have to make the right choice. Island style. Whoa. We got the time that will make you happy. Island style. Oh, yeah. We make your dream come alive in Island style.
We have tiles and tin sets, pieces and grass. crowd. Everything you need, peace on the house out. For the best price and the latest style, take a little drive down to Island Style Car.
We got the time to make you go. Oh. We got the time to make you say, quality, price, service, choice. It's all an Island Style.
Visit us at our showrooms in Belarusa, Rodney Bay, on the John Crompton Highway, Cass Street, and behind Ruby's Gas Station on the Library Viewfort Highway. Or call us on 450-452 or 453-TILE. Island Style, Tan and Bath. When you think tile, think Island Style.
This is Radio Caribbean International. It's now time for the weather news.
So of course, the 1.1 is now time for your weather report as of 12 noon today, presented by Island Style Talamba. The forecast for St. Lucia Valley for the next 24 hours, the winds will be blowing from the east near 25 miles per hour or 41 kilometers per hour with occasional gusts. The weather fair and breezy, occasionally becoming cloudy with a few showers. And there is an advice being average breezes. Small craft operators and sea beavers are advised to exercise caution due to brisk winds and locally rough seas. The forecast for Los Angeles, fair skies, occasionally becoming cloudy with some light to moderate showers. And the weather summary, the Atlantic high pressure system will continue to generate moderate to brisk easterly winds and locally rough seas across the eastern Caribbean over the next few days. Patches of blue level clouds moving along the wind flow will cause some scattered showers over the Lesser Antilles during the forecast period. And this was your weather forecast as of 12 noon today, presented by Island Style Talamba.
This has been RCI's Weather News. For more information, call the Weather Hotline at 454-3452. RCI 101 number 1.
Island Star. We got the time to make you go. We got the time to make you say.
Spaces and ground. Everything you need, peace on the house out. For the best price and the latest style, take a little drive down to Island Style Car.
We got the time to make you go. Oh. We got the time to make you say, quality, price, service, choice. It's all an Island Style.
Visit us at our showrooms in Belarusa, Rodney Bay, on the John Crompton Highway, Cass Street, and behind Ruby's Gas Station on the Library Viewfort Highway. Or call us on 450-452 or 453-TILE. Island Style, Tan and Bath. When you think tile, think Island Style.
And welcome back to the lunchroom here at Radio Caribbean International. Now, of course, we're about 22 minutes out before the hour of 2 o'clock. And if you'd like to call in to tell us what's on your plate today, the number to do so is 452-3046. Again, 452-3046. And you can also reach us on our WhatsApp number. That is 724-0008. Again, 724-0008. 0008. And of course it is April 1st. Hopefully we won't get any April Fool's calls today. But of course we do hope that you are aware of the possibility of individuals coming with something to perhaps make you laugh or to fool you. Of course, a caller last week did raise the issue of the challenge of the times, especially in terms of digital literacy, and how there is so much afoot in terms of fraud and the challenges with where we get information from and fake news and deep fakes and the rise of artificial intelligence, making it possible for nearly everybody with just a phone in their hands to be able to do all manner of things, which was certainly unthinkable just 20 years ago. In fact, quite recently noticed video circulating from, which was produced back in, I think, 2001, where the BBC was speaking to the rise of picture texting. Because at that time, I mean, most people were just dependent on SMS. And then there was this ability now for phones to be able to send photographs. And that was a big question mark. Would people be able to make that move? Would it become just as popular? Would they be willing to pay? Because it was going to be for at a price, you know, each time you might have sent a photograph. And we can see, of course, how certainly the entire world has completely changed in terms of the application of technology, information and communications technologies, and how it certainly has made a difference in everyday lives and how we interact and how we do business in every sense of the word. So certainly very, very keen that we are embracing the technology, but at the same time being aware that there are, of course, implications with respect to the use of technology. And of course, that risk that is at play, that there are sometimes people who are left behind. We might be in a 4.0 era, but then you still have some people who are might not even be at 1.0 in terms of the use of technology. And so you've got a spectrum developing of users who are at different points and who certainly do need different means to be able to transact business, for example. And so certainly it's something to be mindful of. Just yet another challenge in terms of being versatile. And that would require public services, government, private sector to be able to handle all these various technologies at the same time. Now, last week, of course, we saw the government heading to Parliament to approve the estimates of revenue and expenditure. And what was put forward was a budget of 2.057 billion Eastern Caribbean dollars, which the government is hoping to be able to spend for the year 2025-2026. Of course, we heard from the Prime Minister, certainly pointing out the what he saw as significant successes by his government in terms of the issue of surpluses and ensuring that the government was in fact able to meet its current commitments as well as its debt commitments as well, and still have some money left over for putting into the capital fund, the capital expenditure. And I do believe we have a clip coming from that debate of the Prime Minister, Minister of Finance, the Honorable Philip J.P.S., speaking to some of that in his wrap-up to the debate which ended on Friday.
Yeah, Mr. I'm speaking about the surplus, Mr. Speaker. So, Mr. Speaker, the primary surplus is a measure of the fiscal position in the country where you can pay on your loans. That's all it is. And it means that the government's expenditure minus its revenue can give it space to pay down on its interest on its loan. That's all. Very simple, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I understand that the leader of the opposition said to the press, and that is why he casted them things inside of here, you know, that the progress of this country is good is because we have raised tax revenue. Now listen to the logic. Listen to the logic. Let us agree that the revenue has increased because of taxation, he says. He calls it taxation. Now look at, let us follow it step by step. And that's not economics, that's regular common sense. You bring in a set of goods into the country and you say the tax is too high. The tax is too high, but you brought in the goods. Now the tax is too high and these goods are so expensive, people will not buy them because people have no money to buy them. So you'll not be able to bring in more goods. So how you'll have more revenue? Simple logic. It's very simple. If the country's progress is determined by increases in taxes, what you'll find is that people will not be able to buy the goods that you bring to the country. So where will you, how you increase the revenue? How would the revenue increase? They're buying the goods. But I agree, part of the revenue increase is due, part is due to inflation. And I said so. I said part of it was because of inflation. But the majority of revenue is increase is caused because of the increase in economic activity in the country. And it's clear. I mean, Speaker, all, you know, economics is not a subject in isolation. All the indicators are there. The lowest unemployment, they say is wrong. The lowest unemployment, they say is wrong. The highest level of bank deposits, they say is wrong too. The Chamber of Commerce says that business confidence is high, they say is wrong. Building, you cannot find building materials, they say that's wrong. There's a construction boom, they say is wrong. You can't find workers in construction, skilled workers, they say it's wrong. Everything is wrong. The United Workers Party want people to live in a false reality. No matter how they see it. You talk about taxes, we remove VAT on building materials. We remove VAT on building materials. 12.5% VAT of building materials, and you speak about taxes. We have increased the minimum wage. In fact, we have put together a minimum wage. We have increased the salaries of civil servants. We've paid a back pay. We've even paid the back pay that you could not pay. This government can say that St. Lucia is experiencing economic growth, and the fact that that economic growth has been verified by the IMF in its documents. And you can see it. You can feel it. Businessmen tell you that there was no January this year. There was no January, people say. You can feel it, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in the month of February, this government put into the economy $75 million. We paid, you speak about the country not improving. We paid bonuses for the first time. We gave pensioners 2 bonuses, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, wait for the policy and you'll see. So what the United Workers Party wants to do? They want us to live in a false reality. They believe that you can lie, you can misinform, you can say the same thing over and over again, and the people will believe you.
And that piece, of course, coming out of the wrap-up, his second presentation on the estimates of revenue expenditure, which occurred last week, Friday. Of course, it wasn't without some level of controversy. Again, the leader of the opposition was not able to debate on the estimates. And perhaps I think he has only himself to blame. Again, we've been seeing a situation of a cat and mouse at play with respect to attempts by the leader of the opposition to debate. It would appear he wants to have the final word in the debate. Now, what normally happens, and in normal practice, of course, is that the Minister of Finance will, or any minister for that matter, will introduce a bill, or they will introduce something into Parliament, right? That's the normal parliamentary practice. The expectation is that the individual who is shadowing that respective portfolio will then speak and respond to what has in fact been raised by the respective minister. So in this instance, we have a Minister of Finance who has laid forward the estimates. Not yet the appropriation bill. That is something that's going to come sometime later on, presumably this month or next month. The expectation then is that the shadow minister of finance, right, will then make his rebuttal, right? So one would have, in fact, expected that Mr. Chastney would probably have spoken on the Thursday because, of course, the address given by the Minister for Finance, the Prime Minister, was Tuesday evening. There was a one-day break to allow time for the opposition to prepare their rebuttal. So it was not even a situation where the opposition was being asked to come on the following day, right, or the same day. We've seen this in the past as well, to be able to rebut. And we've in fact seen in the former, when Mr. Chastney was Minister for Finance, the opposition leader, the shadow Minister for Finance, who was then the current Prime Minister, would have had to have rebutted the following day, right? That was not even the case. He was, in fact, as rightfully so, I would say, afforded time to be able to prepare, to be able to go through the relevant documents, which he would have probably gotten from the weekend before in any case, but to be able to hear what was presented by the Minister of Finance and then have time to prepare a rebuttal, and then to come on the Thursday to be able to give his presentation. And, of course, remember, there were about 16 other individuals to speak within that debate. And all of Thursday passed, and the Minister of Finance, and the Shadow Minister, leader of the opposition, chose not to speak. Okay, one can argue, maybe it is that he figures, because there's a big gap and it's 15 on one side and 2 on the other, well, perhaps we would allow some of the individuals on the governing side, of course, to be able to go first, and then you would be able to come in maybe midway or thereabouts to be able to debate. But that was not even done. And so, again, he waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. And it would appear that the leader of the opposition seems to think that all of Parliament invariably must yield to his wishes, that everybody has to fall in line with what he deems or how he deems things should go in terms of speaking order. Now, normally, speaking orders are agreed to and should be agreed to beforehand, and it should be done in a very cordial and gentlemanly fashion, right? That is the normal expectation, that individuals will, on both sides of the House or the Senate, would say, okay, based on the numbers of individuals that we have, maybe if we had it in such a way where it's like a 2-to-1 ratio, well, then two of ours will speak, and then two of the government side will speak, one of the opposition will speak, and then a back and forth, something to that effect. But when you clearly are dealing with a situation where, in fact, there are only two opposition speakers, one would really, really like to hope that the opposition would, in fact, ensure that it does not jeopardize its opportunity to speak. And speak in the House of Assembly, where it really should matter as a matter of record, to be able to go down in Hansard. This was said by the leader of the opposition representing his interests. And in the first instance, remember, the whole idea of Parliament is to speak, parler. It's about speaking in Parliament. It's about speaking and representing the interests of those who have elected you. It's a representative duty and obligation that one has. So the games of cat and mouse, and hey, no, you have to speak first, and this really and truly is very unfortunate. And so we've seen it happen in the past. And one would have thought that there would have been some reasonable approach on the part of the leader of the opposition in this instance to ensure that he does not get caught in this situation again. Because the reality is, the government has the majority. Once a bill is placed down and a minister proposes a bill, right? Once that minister has spoken for that bill, really and truly, it is the obligation now of the opposition to speak to the bill as well. Because otherwise, the government can, in fact, decide at that point, well, you know what? Oh, okay, you don't want to speak then. Therefore, it means that everything is fine with what is being presented. Everything is good. And so we can move forward. We can move ahead with it. Right? And we've seen that happen in the past as well. So clearly it is important for the opposition to also certainly play their role in terms of speaking and representing the interest of the minority. Right? So let's hope, of course. I mean, this was one round of the process, the estimates which were already laid. Let us certainly hope that in the debate on the appropriation bill, the debate on the policies and the economic aspects underpinning the government's plan for the year, let us hope that the leader of the opposition does not miss out on another opportunity to do just that. Let's take in a call at this time. Good afternoon, and welcome to the lunchroom.
Hi, good afternoon, colleagues. How are you?
Very good, thanks, caller. How are you doing?
I am blessed.
Wonderful.
You know what I want somebody to do for me? Is simply go over the old debate and see where the leader of the opposition in the last two previous United Workers Party administration spoke. Because I listened to the people who are supposed to be conservatives and for fairness, etc. Right? They do not go and look at the history. Because it's true that when Philip Jepier was leader of the opposition, he responded first to the budget.
Right.
I remember people even questioning, why was he speaking? Why he was not speaking? Why he was not speaking last as Labour Party and leader of the opposition? I remember that discussion. People choose to forget it deliberately. It cannot be that in a debate. It has to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody talk about the will of debate. There's two of you. So the two of you speak last, everybody speak before you. I can't see the fairness in that. Rules of debate. I mean, you could go back as far back as this guy, Louis George. When Louis George was the sole member of the opposition in the House.
Right.
You know? So why must we change the rules for one man and his cohort? It doesn't make sense to me.
And it doesn't appear that the cohort has any issue with debating, because Mr. Bradley Felix did debate, I think, on the first day. All right, so he did in fact make his submission, his presentation. But in fact, in all honesty, the expectation would normally have been that the shadow minister, i.e., the leader of the opposition in this instance, should have probably spoken even before Mr. Felix. He chose not to do so, that's fine. Whatever the case may be.
That is what Philip Jepier did.
Right.
He started the debate for the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So therefore, people play for our minds. You know, I listen to the talk shows and then they play for our minds about this, what would be the speaker that allow Shastner to speak, right? But when the Labour Party was in opposition, what did the speaker do to them? Right? In a Creole guy on them, Masti Peyo, you fucking know, they did that, that's politics, as if it's something new going on, right?
Mm.
You know? I think that somebody have to be, the people in St. Lucia, starting from the leaders of the religious leaders, have to be honest and speak truth to power. It cannot be that way. Nobody has done it. That's not a God-given right. All right? Okay, beggars are not choosers. You're the opposition. You have to work with the leader of government business. All right? You understand me?
Yeah. Totally. Totally understand.
And honestly, I listened to the debate, right? At least yesterday. And I must give credit and kudos to Timothy. You know? The first time I heard Timothy go against him to say that he ought to have spoken. Right? You're speaking to the budget. You're not speaking to what ministers see.
Precisely.
Right? The budget is presented, you're speaking precisely. To the budget.
Precisely.
That is a provision bill.
Well,
you know?
Yes.
It's a statement. And when you are a minority, so therefore you cannot, it's not one side figure, etc. In a proper debate, the proposition speaks, then the opposition speaks.
Yeah.
Then the seconder comes in. Right? So they space it out for you. Right? That is fair. I'm not hearing that. You know what I mean? And I wish the powers that be, the people, especially opinion leaders, those who call in talk shows, the talk show hosts, would come out and say that he had enough time to do that.
He had more than enough time to, in fact, even speak first on the Thursday, you know?
Yeah.
That is really, because it's not even like you did not get an entire day, clear day, right, within which you had to prepare. And your estimates are always given to you even the week before. They would have been given to him by the parliament, right?
Yes.
Prior to the... So you had an entire weekend, plus you also, of course, had the time to listen to the presentation by the Minister of Finance to come back. And that is what... I mean, you've got to come down to the brass tacks of what you are there to do. You are there
the
to respond to the estimates.
It's not policy. Not policy. And you have shadow ministers.
But unfortunately, Mr. Chastney seems more intent on playing politics, more intent on trying to get at certain individuals, certain politicians. I mean, it should not matter when Mr. Relais or Mr. Frederick are going to speak. But you need to be concerned about when you are going to speak. When you need to make sure that you speak.
You had
and the
budget
debate
in front of you. Speak to the budget, the estimates and revenue. How government will raise the revenue. Will it be in place, right? The expenditure, that's what you have to talk about, right? You know, and show manliness in that. And I'm listening to the defenders, right? And what they are saying, you know what I mean?
Well, I haven't heard very many defenders, to be honest. But maybe I need to try to.
No,
what is the argument?
I listen to all the talk shows. Eh?
What is the argument?
I watch YouTube and I listen to the town hall meetings, etc.
No, what is the argument? What is the defense? What's being said in his defense?
Well, the defense is that Aaron should be addressing to her, Hille, and them first. You know. So he had to speak before him to speak. You understand? That is the gist of what he says.
But that is unheard of. The only person who had to speak was the Minister of Finance.
Yes.
That's who had, and he spoke. He spoke on Tuesday.
Yes.
And you are supposed to be dealing with that issue, the estimates that are being put forward. That's who you have to, that's the person who spoke. Everybody effectively is sort of responding to the Minister of Finance, if you like. In that sense, right? Because he's the one presenting. So that argument holds no water, no water at all.
It is not about argument and rules of debate. It is a political argument.
Well, I mean,
you'd hear the opposition parties. That's what they're saying, and the handlers. That's what they're saying. Right? You know. But we have to tell our children the rules. If I go to a school, I would tell the children in a civic class, that is how debate is done. You know what I mean? The government have so many members, and the government have so many members, and they are allocated correctly. And as the leader of government business said, right, they had it spread, even out.
Yeah.
Okay? So he would speak, and then two others come after him, etc. they had enough time to talk about other things. But basically, we're making it the policy of a person. Right? And if I think, well, these are the two.
But if Mr. Chastney were to be honest with himself and think back to when he was Prime Minister and Minister for Finance, as far as I can recall, even after whoever might have been the last speaker for the opposition, right? Whoever that person may have been, let's say it was Alva Baptiste, who would have been the last speaker of the for the opposition, there would be other members from his party and his government who would speak after the last speaker.
That is what I'm saying, that let's speak truth to power. Play those things, right? Play those things. Because to show...
In fact, I think normally Mr. Guy Joseph would be one of the last speakers.
Exactly.
Right? Isn't that the case?
Exactly.
So why is it that it is that he must now dictate, right?
Yeah.
The entire order of who speaks when. It's completely unheard of.
That is what I want to pose to fair-minded citizens in this country. Why was it good for the Bush in 26 and 21 and is not good for the Gander in 2021 to 2026? Well, that is all I'm asking.
Thanks very much for that point, caller.
All right.
We're going to have to end it there. And in fact, we're also over time here on our program. Of course, we'll have to continue that conversation perhaps tomorrow for another one of the lunchroom at, of course, Radio Caribbean International. In the meantime, please be safe and enjoy the rest of your day. I'm your host, Calix George Jr., saying goodbye.